Thank you very much. I'm glad you left some time for the talk itself. So this is joint work with Eric Tasselin from ESTI, and it is a work in progress. It's more like a program, really, and let me describe first what we are trying to do. Yeah. So, as I told you, let's manage that. So, what I'm trying to do is to have a theory of optimal management of bond portfolios. Now, we already have such theories. For instance, the Merton theory for optimal management of stock portfolios and so on. And one could say it's basically the same thing. Well, not really, because there are some difficulties which are specific to bonds. The first one, everything in there, the first one is that when you have a stock, well, when you model stocks and so on, typically they teach you markets are, there are relatively few risks affecting stocks. They'll tell you they are, you model stocks using Brownian motions with perhaps one, two, three risks. One thinks of stocks in that terms, just that many risks affecting stocks. On the other hand, if you have a bond, well, this is the yield curve that is the interest rate R of T as a function of T. Now this curve changes, and every change in if the long rate changes, the short rate changes, every rate change, I'm not going to tell you that. And in principle, at least, each individual risk, each individual interest rate is a source of risk for the stock. So the basic object which helps us to price bonds is this curve. This is what we use to price bonds. And clearly, this curve can be deformed in many different ways, and you would think that because of that, since there are many ways to change this curve, there are many risks affecting the yield curve, affecting bonds, as opposed to stocks. So that's the first source of difficulty. You would expect that there are more risks affecting bonds than risks affecting stocks, and this is why bond markets tend to be incomplete as opposed to stock markets. You mentioned that. The other difficulty is that, as you know, stocks are time invariant. If I have an IBM stock today, I still have an IBM stock tomorrow, and it is the same. But if I have a bond today, if I have a 10-year bond today, tomorrow comes, I do no longer have a 10-year bond. I have a 10-year minus one-day bond. And eventually, the bond dies. Eventually, so I cannot just. So, for instance, the option of buy and hold, which is always possible for stocks, is not possible for bonds, or is possible up to a certain extent. So I say that by saying stocks are time invariant. As time goes, the stock isn't changed, even except if the company fails, and so on and so forth. So certain strategies possible for stocks are not possible for bonds. So you have more sources of risk. And how would you address, and the aim of what I've been trying to do is to try to address directly these difficulties. To address the first difficulty, we're trying to build a theory which will work directly on this set of curves. As in statistics, you see, statistics are probably this kind. And one option is you choose a parametric model. You say a priori that it depends, curve depends on finitely many parameters, and you work on that. You have to choose a model. So here we'd like to work on a model where, well, the curve itself varies. So the curve itself will vary without, there'll be no a priori assumption of the shape of the curve, except that it's continuous and so on. And the other thing we're trying to do is to try to define time-invariant objects to carry strategies. In other words, we're going to express strategies in terms of time-invariant objects, similar to stocks. express the strategies within these time-invariant objects, and then translate them back into bonds. So you see, it's basically, perhaps there's nothing new, but basically a way to look at things. We try to express strategies in terms of time-invariant objects, and we're going to work directly in terms of the yield curve. So the first thing we have to do is to study the space of yield curves. So what are you going to assume on the space of yield curves if you're not assuming a finite model? Well, we're going to assume a few things. So let's call the space of yield curves. So yield curves, yeah. So in fact, I make a mistake here already. I'm not going to talk about the space of yield curves, I'm going to talk about the set of zero coupon prices. So I'm going to look at curves which are more like that will represent the price, so that will represent the price at the price that represent this. I hope I put it here. No, I didn't. So let me put it here. So let us say that P of X will be the price P of X will be the price at time X, at time zero, of 1 euro available at time, of 1 euro available at time X. So it is the price of the zero coupon with maturity X. So it has this shape, it is going down. As you know, going from the zero coupon curve to the yield curve is a relatively easy task. Well, so we're going to look at this curve, the curve of zero coupon curves, and we're going to say, so it's defined for all maturities, positive maturities, because you look at the future, and now you have these guys. Now, what do they mean? You should think of them. You should think of them as meaning that the curve decreases. It decreases. It is square integrable. Some derivatives are square integrable as well. So that basically, you should think of that as meaning that the curve goes to zero at infinity. That's what you think of. It would mean also that the curve is differentiable to a certain extent. If you put here, if S here is 1, so it would mean that the function is square integrable as well as its first derivative. If S is 2, the function is square integrable, the first derivative is square integrable, the second derivative is square integrable, and so on. So this gives curves which go to zero fast and which are smooth. But there is an interest for us in taking low values of S. We will, taking low values of S, we can put here derivatives which are not integer, non-integer values of the non-integer values of the derivative. So, this space of curves, why do we take a space of curves like that? Well, because number one, it is assuming very little on the zero coupon curve. We're not even assuming that it is decreasing and so on. We're just assuming that prices of zero coupons go to zero as the maturity increases. So it's assuming very little. On the other hand, this is a Hilbert space. It is a Hilbert space. It has a square integrable norm. It's very similar to L2. And this means that one will be able to do computations in infinite dimensions, which are extremely similar to the computations that people do in finite dimension. And finally, since it is a Hilbert space, in this space of curves, you can do statistics, you can do regressions, you can do a lot of things. So the Hilbertian framework is a good one, and these curves have a certain number of mathematical properties. For instance, you can multiply two of them. It's an algebra. That is, if you multiply two numbers, P and Q, which belong to the space, you get a curve, which is again a function, is again in the space. And basically, if S is high enough, this space consists of smooth functions. Let me point out, this may seem perhaps, for people in finance and so on, may seem like a bit strange, but let me point out, for instance, the difficulty. What would you call a kind of difficult point? What is a zero coupon? Mathematically speaking, what is a zero coupon? Well, a zero coupon is something that would come right here. A zero coupon with matrix S is something that would come right here. Here, maturity X. So the price of the zero coupon is P of X. It's the value at this point. And mathematically speaking, this would be, we'd write it like that, this is a Dirac mass, this is delta of X, the Dirac mass, the point mass, operating on P. This is the value of P at X. This is what is called the Dirac mass at X operating on P. So, if you accept that this is a space of prices, then portfolios will be in the dual space. And this dual space will have to contain zero coupons. How does that fit into that? I'm saying that is the curve of prices. Portfolios will belong to the dual, and here, since these functions are all continuous, then the dual space contains Dirac masses. So it is mathematically consistent to say, here is my set of prices, my set of zero coupon prices, and portfolios will operate on that, and zero coupons will just be Dirac masses, and Dirac masses will appear here, which is in the dual of that space. So let us accept for the time being the mathematical framework. This is a set of zero coupons, or zero coupon prices. This is my set of curves, and you see I'm asking really very little. Now I think I'm going to skip a few things. For people who enjoy mathematics, it is a Hilbert space, so there is what is called a group of left translation. Somewhere there will be an infinitesimal generator, which will be a very useful mathematical tool. But let us proceed now with what I call the moving frame. Well, what do I call now the moving frame? Well, let us see it as follows. It is what you call the Musiela parametrization. You just do this change of variable. That is, you count time up to maturity, which is a very natural thing to do. In other words, I am today. This is my set of zero coupon prices. I am tomorrow. When I go tomorrow, so this is at date T, and at date S bigger than T, I will have something else. So So I think personally it's much nicer not to worry about the date. Today we're January 24th, but always refer as date to maturity. We always count in terms of date to maturity, which is what is known as the Musiela parameterization, which is quite familiar to people in finance. So I don't, the fixed frame is we are today January 24th, 2004, that's the fixed frame, but it's not the frame we're operating in. The frame we're operating in is today we're today. And tomorrow tomorrow will be today again. So that's the moving frame. That is, you simply count in time to maturity. Now this is well known. It is not my idea by any means. This is a Musiela parameterization. And if it is so well known, how come it is not usually written in textbooks of finance? Well, because if you start writing the bond price dynamics in that frame, you get something like that. So now I'm writing, now I've done my homework, that is PT of X is the price, so that's a zero coupon price. PT of X, price at time T of 1 euro, delivery time T plus X. We're counting time to maturity. So we are really here. P tilde, that is a discounted price in a standard way. And then what do the equations look like? Well, the bond price dynamics are going to look something like that, which are very similar to what you would see. You know, I'm writing that in integrated form. You used to see it as dpt equals nothing plus that plus that. You're using to see it as dpt equals nothing plus, forget that, d over dx plus sigma dw. But here you have this nasty thing coming in. And why does it come in? Because, you know, if you work in banks, you remember every day you look at the yield curve and you know there are several changes. The one change today from tomorrow, which is because, well, we're just moved one day. So in other words, the yield curve is going to, the zero coupon curve is going to change for two reasons. Number one, the first one is this yield curve is going to change from today from tomorrow. For two reasons. The first reason is that we're not going to be here, we're going to be here. And the second reason is that it's actually going to change. And the little part that says, well, you're still keeping this, this little part, comes up here. Right? So, and this is not nice, because if you write this, perhaps I'll just do it so that you can see it in more familiar form. If I just write it like that, if I write something like that, then it's something you're very familiar with, except that you have this nasty thing. And now look at it. P, the problem here is that P is not a number, it's a curve. It is a curve. So it's an equation in a space of curves. It's a stochastic partial differential equation in the space of curves. And in that space of curves, if Ps is a curve, then you have a d over dx, which is well defined, has nothing to do with a d over dt. And so you have what looks like a stochastic partial differential equation with an unbounded operator here. Okay. So this is to be understood as stochastic partial differential equation in infinite dimension. I'm not going into what I have here, but you can realize that I'm in Hilbert space. I have a huge opportunity to put here infinitely many sources of risk. I can be finite, or I can be infinite, so no problem with that. And the volatilities and the mean here belong to appropriate spaces. Now, what we'd really like is to give a meaning to all this, and nicely not so. So here you have a stochastic partial differential equation in H and so on. It's you have a curve here, the unbounded operator, the right-hand side is not continuous, but anyway, mathematicians do their work, and they find out that under reasonable assumptions, and here, some ability, whichever, now, the price of a zero coupon times zero is 1. This is initial values. You would expect that the initial zero coupon curve would satisfy this property and that the price would be positive. And here, I haven't told you what that means, what's a d over dx. Well, this is the domain of the operator. This is really what I'm saying here, that the initial zero coupon curve is differentiable. So this operator is well defined on that. And that, not only is it well defined, but it is differentiable infinitely many times. So I'm saying here, start with a zero coupon curve, which happens to be differentiable, as well as first derivative, second derivative, and third derivative. Start with an infinite differentiable yield curve. I think no problem with that. So it's a particular starting point. And then everything goes perfectly well, and you have these very nice things, which tell you basically that the whole mode is consistent. Saying that the whole thing is consistent. Yeah, very nice. And then you have everything you could wish for. Then this is telling you that you can actually give a meaning to this to this stochastic differential equation in the space of curves, and you find out that you have a curve that the zero coupon price change in such a way that it is always positive, the zero coupon curve is always infinitely differentiable. Why is that so? Not because of the equation, but because the starting one was. And you have this equation, which is needed because really it's really telling you something about the interest rate. So this would be the interest rate. How do you get the interest rate from the curve? Well, it's telling you that if you are consistent and you can get the interest rate from this curve, everything is continuous, so you can have explicit expressions. And so this is basically saying that the mode is consistent, and even though you started from a very general space of curves, you end up with exactly what you expect, and you have a completely coherent formulation. For the mathematically minded, well, this is you prove that by going through the semi-group, and you have what is called my solutions, and you prove that actually they're strong solutions. But let us just say we are successful in we're successful in formulating a mathematical framework whereby the zero coupon curve changes randomly in its space. And it is, how can I say it is, non-parametric. It's really the curve that is changing. And you can have it change according, if you wish, according to one risk, two risks, or infinitely many risks. So that's the mathematics. Now, let me get into something that was found before in the literature, but not perhaps used to all the extent it could, and that is what we call rollovers. Now, let's go back to the idea that we want to find invariant objects. Now, a zero coupon with maturity T is not an invariant object, because as you go by, you cash in the zero coupon, it's dead. What we call a rollover is something different. A next rollover bond would be a portfolio a portfolio with a constant time to maturity. Think, remember, in France, there is a way we always say to make a donkey move. You have a carrot, and you hang a stick at the carrot end of it, and the donkey moves because it's going to try to catch the carrot. But unfortunately, as he moves, of course, the carrot moves with him, and the time to maturity is constant. But that's exactly it. So, financially speaking, think of it as a money account which you can close at 3 months' notice. I give you a money account, but I tell you you can close it whenever you want, but I need 3 months' notice. So that's exactly that. Right? It's not a day-to-day account, but I can close it, but I need 3 months' notice. So at any time, at a fixed time, it is a zero coupon of maturity 3, but it's going to move away from you. So physically, you realize it in this way. And note, however, that if you start with a money account that will mature that with 3 months notice, if you put $1 in it the first day, as you go, it will gather money, so it will no longer be $1. So in other words, the next question is, can you make this guy self-financing? In other words, your money account with maturity 3 months, as you keep it, gathers money in. So you can easily compute its value. So in the moving frame, for instance, you see, I write it that way. It is a delta S. It is a Dirac mass in the moving frame with constant maturity. So that's the carrot. The carrot is a distance S. So it moves in the moving frame. So it's a constant distance moving frame. Its value is this. F, of course, is the forward rate. And you have price dynamics, and the price dynamics are rather instructive. Why did I write the price dynamics? Because they look very much like the price dynamics you had here. Excuse me. Except you no longer have this term. There's no d over dx because the time to maturity is constant. Time to maturity is constant. So it's that. So you can. And these are what we call rollovers. And we'll try to express strategies in terms of rollovers. These are our invariant objects. Now you try to develop the theory. It is not enough. Try to develop the theory. So you have all these zero coupon curves moving around. Now it is well known that there should be a non-arbitrage condition. What is the non-arbitrage condition be? Well, it should be a linear relation between the volatilities on the one hand and the trend on the other. So that will be the non-arbitrage condition. The trend is a linear combination of the volatilities. There are some mathematical niceties which are expressed here. In particular, there should be conditions, Novikov conditions, stuff of that kind. So that's the non-linear arbitrage condition. It's very classical. If I is finite, it's exactly the classical one. And you end up with, as always, by defining the martingale measure. So, if this is the non-arbitrage condition, then there is no, if this condition is satisfied, then there is no arbitrage on the yield curves, and there is an equivalent martingale measure, and the equivalent martingale measure can be expressed in terms of the historical martingale measure by this, where Ct is given explicitly by that. So this is, if you wish, one way of seeing the Girsanov formula. Anyway, you have the equivalent martingale measure, and this is the density of it. There is no surprise there. Am I being clear? Tom. Yeah. Good. Thank you for mentioning that. M, so let us go back to that. And I should have said more about it. Yes, so you see. So you see, it is a function. So dp of t, that you have this curve. All these are curves. So you have this is in h. So this is a curve. So it should you could really have dpt of x. So perhaps I should write it that way. Could we so let me rewrite this again. So it is a similar equation to the equations you write whenever you have this forward rate measure. So you write an equation for each maturity. So this means that for every time to maturity x, dp tilde t of x, so you remember how strange it is, you have write one for each time to maturity, equals d over dx of p tilde t of x. And you see that it's a 2t, but to this big 2x, plus p tilde t of x m t of x, so it is a curve, actually. And this is why it was important that I mentioned it was an algebra, because you're staying within the space. You still have to make some mathematical sense, plus p tilde t of x, sum of sigma I s of x dw ti, and it is always for each x. Sorry? dt, yes. So, thank you. I should have written it, but so it is simply a concise mathematical way of writing the equations you have seen for whenever you have a forward rate model or a bond price model, it's for a fixed maturity. But here we're writing it for a fixed time to maturity. Right? If it were a fixed maturity, you would not have this term. And by the way, I have here a modeling problem, which I don't know how to solve, which is, after all, these are models. And perhaps if the first guy who started finance would have written these equations in a moving frame, then would we worry about the fixed frame, and there's no particular reason which we decide which is a good one. Am I being clear here? So, fixed time to maturity instead of maturity, and because, okay, fine.
So, that's no arbitrary condition. You also get the gamma from the model, like the integral of the sigma.
Well, the arbitrage condition, you get the M from the model. You get the gamma from the model, absolutely. So the general idea... the HGM equation. It's equivalent to the HGM equation, and that's the way you prove it. So you expect your model to be arbitrage-free. The way it goes is you expect your model to be arbitrage free, and this is a necessary and sufficient condition for no arbitrage. That is, you are supposed, so these are curves, or if you prefer, this means that mt of x plus sigma over I of gamma I, which are numbers, sigma I t of x equals 0. So there is a simultaneous value of gamma I t, which solve that for all x. So we could really, what we're really saying is x equals 0, all x. Okay, so that's what we're saying. Fine, so now, what do I have to say about optimal? So please remember now, that from all this you can define this random variable, Xt, which helps define the equivalent Martingale measure. And now what about optimal portfolios? Now we do something extremely classical, which is we use a duality method. So, first of all, portfolios. Well, portfolios, you know, in the portfolio that will be like, that will contain things like zero coupons, like Dirac, which you consider now as Dirac masses. And so a portfolio, a portfolio is something that operates on prices. It operates linearly on prices, so it's really something which is the dual of that space of curves. You could have a combination of zero coupons, that is a combination of Dirac masses and so on. It's all the Hilbertian framework. So you have an admissible portfolio. It's something like that. You have a technical condition here, but it operates on prices. And then, so it is what you would expect. It is a standard way of optimizing portfolios of using a duality method. The way it goes is, here I have this investor with utility U, which typically in finance is quadratic, but it could also be something else. So now, wrong of course, excuse me. You're going to look, so WT is the terminal wealth. So you're going to look at he wants to optimize the expected utility of terminal wealth. So you forget about everything that happens between time 0 and T, and you look at whatever terminal wealth will maximize its utility subject to that condition, which comes from the fact that wealth would be a martingale. So you look at look for all possible random variables. Or you look at all contingent planes that you can decide at time t, whose initial price is W naught. So this is all contingent planes that can be decided at time t. This is their value at time their value at time zero. And then you maximize the expected utility of all these guys. Yes?
Can W be negative?
Now it depends what you put on U, because I'm not giving details on U, but you can choose, for instance, answer yes, but you can also put in constraints. Example, take U equals 1/2 of x squared plus lambda x, which is quadratic. Then you allow it to be negative. However, take U of x equal logarithm of x. I am perfectly, in this framework, it's perfectly allowable to take U of x equals log of x. Then it can no longer be negative, because because it's agreed then that if you take a negative value, it gives negative infinity. And it is also admissible to throw in a constraint. So this is a concise formulation, but as long as it remains convex, I forgot to say, U is convex. As long as it is a convex optimization problem at the end, you can accommodate all the constraints you wish. So if you're worried, I could add WT positive. I could certainly do that. I could add WT positive everywhere. I could add all that. It makes the thing more complicated, of course. Once you've done that, so you're looking only, so you see, you look at all contingent claims, whose price at time zero is W0, where W0 is initial wealth, and you look at all those which would maximize this expression. Okay, so that's a finite optimization problem. So that's a problem at time t, and then the next question is, whenever you've done that, can you actually achieve that by a self-financing portfolio? So is it achievable now? So it's a two-step procedure. I'm not which is quite used in general in optimization theory. First, look at the best terminal wealth, and once you have it, see if it can be achieved. Well, it can be if you have a suitable condition, and so here I had a condition I'm not going into, but let us say perhaps that is always achieved in finite dimension. This, you have a technical condition here. It's always the case in finite dimension, but it is a condition that would relate for every I. This expression, that's P0 translated by T, with some gamma. It's always true in finite dimension. In infinite dimension, you do have some problems because the operator sigma is compact. Never mind. But then you have a solution. You can give an optimal portfolio. So what will the optimal portfolio look like? So I have not told you certain things. I have not told you what the utility function is. The basic constraint of the utility function is that it is convex. There are other things. But once you have that, we are saying that there is an optimal portfolio in the sense that you can actually solve the problem. I didn't tell you what the problem was. I have not written down the problem. So I'm seeking the portfolio that will maximize terminal wealth. Okay? And there is such a portfolio, and it looks like that. It's a combination of two portfolios, delta zero, so that is a Dirac mass at zero, so that's cash at zero. So you're holding cash at zero, this here, and you're holding, this would be a number, and you're holding something else. What are you holding? Another portfolio. So L20TH star, that is another portfolio. It may be a complicated portfolio holding zero coupons or not zero coupons. There is a portfolio somewhere else. And your optimal portfolio will basically be a linear combination of two portfolios with coefficients which are given in that way. So let me perhaps be more explicit. It may be more helpful. You may think of it this way: theta t of x would be a t delta zero. So what you hold of maturity x is, well, you have the term in a t delta naught, but that is you would say what you hold of maturity zero, that would be at time t, that would be a t, so that's your cash. That would be your cash. And what you hold of other maturities is something which is bt of x, p of x plus t over p tilde of t, these are numbers, times gamma t of x. So that would be what you'd be holding of maturity x. You would be holding a certain content of zero coupons of maturity x. Something of that kind. We can So here you have a kind of mutual friend theorem, because what is being said here, so you have a few consequences here. Perhaps I should forget about the last one. Yes, I would stress this. If you are in finite dimension, so there is no uniqueness. I didn't say it's classical in these problems. It is not true that the optimal portfolio is unique, especially in finite dimension. And in particular, it may be of interest to know that if you have finitely many risks, M risks, then there is an optimal portfolio consisting of M plus 1 rollovers. So you have these rollovers plus cash. So you can express your optimal portfolio as a combination of rollovers plus cash that you hold. So you can express your optimal portfolio as, in terms of cash today, an account that you can give up with 3 months' notice, an account that you can give up in 6 months' notice, another account that you can give up at 1 month's notice, and you can vary the quantity of cash between them. And what I'm pointing out here, it's easy to make the computations in that frame, but then, of course, you can translate back into the fixed frame and see how much that is in others. And I have made some computations at the end that look like that, which is, when you find the paper, if you have exponential utility, it turns out that the discounted wealth invested at maturity S at time t is constant, is deterministic, but the amount invested in cash is random. So as you see, well, this is a beginning. It's basically a framework. There are lots of things to be done. For instance, I would like a question here: is what exactly do you mean by gamma t? What is this mutual friend theorem? What are these optimal portfolios? Could you test that on models of the yield curve? So suppose you take the Vasicek model of the yield curve. So what does that tell you anything? Could you express the optimal portfolios and so on and so forth? But so it's a work in progress. But again, I wish to stress that we try to do two things. The one is try to have a non-parametric model, and the other, make your computations in a time invariant, with time in the moving frame, because then you're dealing with fixed objects. You don't have to worry about your portfolios coming to die and so on and so forth. Okay, I give the floor to Agnès. And